Hey everyone, I'm your host Tom Shaughnessy and welcome back to Chain Reaction, a research-driven podcast that's a part of Delphi Digital. If you're not on Delphi's research portal, you're missing out on the critical analysis read by the top minds in the crypto space, so be sure to check it out. One quick housekeeping item, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. I may personally hold tokens mentioned on the podcast, and you can view our show notes below for our complete disclosures. With that, let's jump into the episode. Hey everyone, welcome back to the podcast. Today I'm thrilled to have on a little round table to discuss token economics and potentially valuation. I have Jan Lieberman, my partner and a co-founder of Delphi Digital. We have Phil Bonello, who's former head of research at Ikigai, and David Puel, who's head of research at Adaptive. How's it going, guys?
It's going great. Thanks for having us.
Hey, all good. Thanks for having me.
So guys, let's jump right in. I want like your quick 30 or 60 second pitch on what token econ means to you. Jan, we can start with you, then Phil, then Dave.
Sure. Token economics is basically the structure of how a token structure is organized, how the token interacts within the ecosystem that it's being used to develop, and how it accrues value. And so token economics is kind of just like a high level understanding of how all those aspects interplay and kind of how any kind of adoption helps to lead to potential price appreciation or just generally how the token interacts with adoption.
Yeah, I would pretty much echo those thoughts. The way that I tend to categorize these different tokens is through either productive or non-productive. So when I say something is a productive asset, I mean that it has exogenous cash flow. So if you hold X, you get an exogenous cash flow through Y. So something similar to kind of like real estate or equities and things like Augur, I consider those to be productive assets. And then there are non-productive assets, which are kind of more like medium of exchange tokens or store of value assets like Bitcoin. So that's generally how I think about token economics from the highest level.
Got it. Dave, what are your thoughts here?
I pretty much, for practical purposes, I align with Vitalik's original, maybe a little bit outdated definition of, you know, structuring a coin in terms of cryptography for securing the past and economic incentives or game theory to secure the future of the network. Within that, you can add the twist of, you know, the focus of price and value appreciation and accrual. But yeah, for the most part, I think that pretty much sums it up.
Got it. That makes sense. So guys, it seems like we're kind of getting to the stage where a lot of projects are rebuilding their token econ to drive some value accrual or to fix kind of their token econ, which was basically just built to raise money. But now they figure out, you know, they actually have to have some utility here or have some type of work token aspect. Do you guys kind of see this as playing out in the end of 2019 into 2020, or do you think that might be off?
Sure, I'll take a stab first. Yeah, I think, you know, when projects first started raising money with these tokens, there wasn't much in the way of research or understanding in terms of how these tokens would interact with the system. And oftentimes they kind of, the primary function was as a vehicle for raising capital, and then secondary and tertiary was how it exactly interacted and how it could accrue value. And so now that we do have empirical data in terms of understanding how these tokens do function in the ecosystem, you're starting to see projects try and learn from the mistakes of predecessors and other tokens while also taking characteristics of projects where the token does function in a productive way. And so because a lot of these projects are still centralized to some degree, they do have the ability to alter the economics. And so you're having projects come forward and realize that there is some level of adoption, but oftentimes it doesn't really translate to any type of value accrual. And so they'll try and institute something that allows the token to accrue value while not necessarily creating a friction for use and kind of making sure that accrual and adoption happen in tandem.
Phil, Dave, I want to hear from you guys. I think you might be on the other side of this kind of comment.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm hopeful that a lot of these products will actually kind of reformat their token structure. But what's not clear to me is kind of the legal ramifications that that entails. So I was in a conversation recently about Brave and their respective token BAT. And BAT is what I would characterize as a non-productive asset. It's a medium of exchange token, something that I believe over time won't accrue substantial value. However, Brave is a really good product. It has, I think, 10 million monthly active users. And the question then becomes, will Brave, this great product, reformat their token to be a great token, a great asset? And I hope so. I kind of think that we will see things like that start to really emerge probably in 2020, 2021. But again, it's not clear to me the regulatory framework that has to kind of accompany some of these transformations.
No, for sure. The legal ramification point is interesting. Dave, what are your thoughts?
Well, as I think out of the roundtable, I may hold the most, for lack of a better word, the most, you could say, skeptical or maximalist in terms of the whole field of token economics. I think as of now, I mean, the question was, as of 2019 or maybe the near future, I think for the most part, fundamentals or the field to explore something that is non-price relative in this industry is extremely early on. So I remain skeptical on which factors could affect actual value accrual over the long term, and therefore the economic incentives that can replicate that for new projects or, you know, recent new projects. For the most part, I think that the industry relies severely in correlation with the price of Bitcoin, in the sense that I think for token economics, even in those terms, the most important fundamental aspect in any altcoin is the price of Bitcoin. And, you know, unless we get adoption and maybe even several years of adoption to track its history and, you know, the reaction of value accrual with real world events, I remain kind of skeptical of the whole field in a way.
It's fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, I would echo a lot of what David just said there. You know, I hold a pretty similar view. You know, when we try to place fundamental valuation within this industry, it kind of falls flat and on its face because nothing is valued in that way. Almost everything is valued, you know, from a narrative perspective. You know, like we look at like Tezos, for example, its recent run up. You know, that's not a fundamental necessarily story. It's this narrative of the staking asset and how exchanges will have to increase their bond to meet their staking requirement. So, you know, whether the asset structure for a lot of these things, just it's interesting to think about for the long term, but from a short term price appreciation standpoint, doesn't really matter.
No, I like the healthy dose of skepticism there. And I guess the other question going back to Brave and BAT, though, is like, that's a great example of a use case where you have a browser with 10 million monthly active users that's growing very fast, a solid team, but a token that's largely useless right now. But they have the ability to potentially fix that token to drive an actual usage within the browser. Do you think that's too much of a reach, or do you think that that's something that could actually happen?
No, I think it would be pretty cool if Brave were to take on, or if BAT were to take on an exchange token type model, similar to like FTX, or, I mean, FTX is probably the best exchange token that I've seen. But yeah, you know, so if there's a certain amount of payments going through Brave, then a certain amount of those payments then get kind of transferred into an equity type token that would be this restructured BAT. So I don't know how viable that is in the short term, but I could certainly see something like that happening down the line.
Yeah, and I think you're also kind of seeing the space start to somewhat shy away from the burn model structure, where you start to realize that on a yield level, you're really not seeing considerable amount of burn. And you know, in terms of thinking of it on an equity-like basis, you're with equity, you're entitled to, you know, more cash flow you're entitled to a larger portion of the company's cash flow as stock buybacks take place. But with burns, it's a little bit different where you're getting, you know, a few percentage points of burn a year, but that really only translates to value for people who are exiting the network. And so you're starting to see a lot of tokens kind of transition almost to this stake and yield velocity sync plus cash flow model. So you it's kind of like two birds, one stone, where you're reducing the circulating supply and actually delivering some kind of immediate tangible yield to individuals. And realistically, you know, you're the amount of capital used for yield or for that buyback is the same amount of money, because it's just a function of the use of the network. And so the kind of somewhat the small benefit is that not everyone stakes, so you get to amplify the returns to those who do. And then you can also off some tokens have and successfully done this, where they'll supplement that initial low yield through issuance that's potentially locked up or something along those lines to kind of encourage additional staking. And it's almost a way to kind of bootstrap the network in the early days.
No, that's fair enough. And yeah, I guess the good example of that is, as you mentioned, kind of Bitfinex and LEO. And a lot of people got really interested in that because it was really easy for people to basically model this out, dive into how much LEO will be burned, watch it in real time. But are you saying basically that PR event or being able to view that in real time is kind of insignificant because they're not actually burning that much?
Yeah, I think part of it is that I think expectations for burns ended up being a lot lower than they actually were, where, you know, everyone's assuming some level of growth. But the fact that we kind of had the market turn back in the second half, everything else, you know, follows Bitcoin, like previously mentioned. And so with Bitcoin kind of tailing off, you're starting to see the volumes in those exchanges tail off a little bit, which implies lower yield, or rather a lower amount burned. So that's where you really see the issue of, all right, at these levels, you're only going to have 1 or 2% of the supply burned a year at current prices. And so you start to think about how you extrapolate that value over time, and it just doesn't come in terms of intrinsic value. It doesn't really arrive at the current market level. And so that's where the burn model kind of falls through when burns really start to slow down and there's just very little reason to actually hold the token.
Oh, that's fair. And Phil and Dave, I want to go back to your kind of point, because Phil, you brought up BAT, and Dave, you kind of talked about how a lot of this is kind of hard to quantify. You guys both mentioned medium of exchange tokens, like a token that's just used for payments within a network and then a user kind of gets rid of it. Dave, could you kind of dive into, or Phil, you know, both of you guys, what actually is the velocity problem? And do you think all tokens that are specifically medium of exchange tokens will eventually just go to zero?
Well, to explain maybe a little bit to the audience, the velocity problem, it's the trade-off when you get, it pertains mostly to medium of exchange coins, and it even it applies to fiat currencies as well. You know, the velocity problem is the more velocity or the more use of a currency or a system as a medium of exchange, the less value accrual over the long term you have, because most people use it as precisely that, a temporary medium where they dump it afterwards, right, after their exchange use. For that, I think the problem is real, even in Bitcoin to some extent. Of course, Bitcoin has a scarcity model that prevents that from happening, game theoretically, over the long term. And I think 10 years, more than 10 years of history, has proven that sufficiently up to now. But even in that sense, even Bitcoin gets affected by this sort of problems where the whole market structure after at the beginning of Q3 2019 got screwed over by a literal Ponzi scheme in China plus token, which performed exactly that problem. It augmented the velocity and the destruction of the system and dumped into the whole market, creating extreme selling pressure and dumping the price, you know, as we've seen, as we're recording today. And of course, that affects me. I think that's going to be a permanent problem in the cryptos that are developed and programmed under that premise. Like Bcash is a great example of that. And also, you have an externality caused by Bitcoin, in the sense that if you may want to hold or even stake any given altcoin over a long period, you're unable to do it because of the lack of, you know, organic internal economics in that altcoin, right? For better or worse, index funds pretty much correlate every asset in the industry. So whenever there's an impact on the price of Bitcoin, it breaks the market structure of your own coin, like it or not, at least as of now. And that's increasingly so since the 2017 bubble. January 2018 marked the place where you don't have any beta, any diversification, any luxury of diversification in this industry. 2017, you could see Q2 and Q4, if you're a fund and you actually held some altcoins, you could see some nice outperformance and non-correlation to Bitcoin from altcoins. From beginning of 2018, that hasn't occurred. You know, correlations rolling from, you know, 90 days, 180 days are still at least 0.6, if not 0.9 in some cases, including the top caps. So it's hard to do, right? Because first of all, it's hard to get adoption, which is pretty much the only driver of actual value accrual for these alternative currencies. I mean, it's hard to onboard users if you get this externalities coming from another system affecting your price and your order books, etc. So that kind of defeats the whole purpose of, you know, okay, I'm producing a new altcoin which has this new game theory and this new economics, so let's test them. Well, yeah, but it's not in a control system, you could say, right? That's my main problem with them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the way that I think about, I'm pretty much on the same line as David. The way that I think about it is kind of a game of hot potato. Some, you know, like you're tossing around this asset. Nobody really wants it. It's just being passed around. The more it's passed around, that's the higher, that's high velocity, right? And this isn't really a new problem. I think the whole MV equals PQ equation doesn't work necessarily so much for valuing these assets, but it's a good heuristic for thinking about the potential for infinite velocity. And so, you know, this is the whole idea behind Gresham's law, where bad money drives out good. As that bad money is being passed around, the good money is being hoarded. And we're probably seeing a bit of that, right? Like pretty much what's happening with altcoins on exchange and like their market prices is there's not a whole lot of new capital coming into the space, but there still is trading of them. And it's just kind of this game of hot potato. While I think there is some new money coming into the Bitcoin space, although the price may not show that over the last couple months. So really what you want to optimize for is more of like a store of value asset where the community is really in line with the supply, kind of the supply characteristics, the censorship resistant characteristics of the network, and the understanding that this asset is really something that you can store your wealth in and be confident in storing your wealth in it for a long period of time.
That's fair enough. I mean, what about, Phil, to your point, what about moving up the stack, though? I mean, once you get out of, say, store value kind of debates on layer one, like what happens when you go into like, you know, the hundreds of Web3 DeFi apps being built where a token may not necessarily be competing to be a store of value, but it may be used by the validators on the back end and it's kind of abstracted away from the users. I mean, a few examples here could be something like the graph where validators, you know, need to own tokens to run, but the users don't really have to interact with it, but the token holders still kind of get upside and the growth of the actual project. Do you guys view all of these as having that issue, or am I kind of misconstrued?
Yeah, I think the graph token is structured as more of a productive asset, right? So like the validators of the network have to stake a certain amount of graph token, I forget what it's called, and then they receive a certain amount of ETH or an exogenous asset in return. Correct me if I'm wrong, but like that to me is a productive asset versus some of these medium of exchange assets, which I view as non-productive assets. So like in the non-productive asset landscape, they all are competing against each other for one and maybe two spots. You know, some are analogous to like gold and silver, right? I think that it follows pretty much a power law distribution.
That makes sense. So guys, let's go into two examples here just to kind of drive this home for the listeners, because we're throwing out a lot of a lot of kind of complex examples here. Let's start with Maker. So the Maker tokens burn to kind of support the network, CDPs, the stablecoin, et cetera. There's obviously a lot of buzz around it with multi-collateral DAI. Jan, you previously talked about the burn model kind of going away or falling out of favor, and then we discussed Bitfinex for a bit. What's your take on how the Maker token kind of interacts with that network?
So, you know, high-level Maker is used for governance, and also when a CDP is closed, you're used to use burn Maker to cover the accrued interest on the debt. And so it makes sense in terms of, you know, overall incentives where Maker holders themselves are incentivized to make sure that the project is stable because they're on the hook when things go south. You want to encourage it. You want to create an environment where there's as much DAI growth as possible, because the more DAI growth there is, then the more potential interest can accrue, which would lead to more burn. I think it makes sense in that respect, but as you've kind of seen, just based on, you know, historic burn levels, it will take either considerable growth in the current DAI supply or considerable, or maybe potential like price drop. But either way, there isn't a significant amount of burn that translates to value. And so it's very difficult to value governance. And I don't think, you know, just taking a step back, everyone's looking to create interesting frameworks, and then there are always constant conversations coming about. But I think governance is, you know, just objectively very difficult to value because there are qualitative aspects to it that don't necessarily translate directly to a valuation. So I think Maker makes sense in that respect, but it will require significant growth in the DAI supply or potentially raising stability fees. But yeah, obviously that has other effects. But in order to really drive value to Maker, it's tough in this situation to see Maker improve purely on fundamentals. Obviously, you have to price in future growth and future speculation, and that's what most of these networks are priced on. But just, you know, thinking about Maker currently, it will need a significant amount of growth, which I think it can certainly achieve if it. You need a host of things, including luck and just things to kind of continue going the way they are. But it's difficult to see a situation where you can justify the current value just based on the current growth and burn.
No, that's great color. Phil, Dave, you guys have any thoughts on the Maker token and dynamics there? I thought that overview was excellent.
Yeah, I pretty much agree. Again, you know, the fundamentals aren't going to support the current market cap. As far as multi-collateral DAI, I'm fairly skeptical of that. But we'll see. I mean, you know, these systems have just become really, really complex. And with more complexity, there are more holes. You know, as we saw, what was it, last week or the week before, with Mika's article of how Maker could be exploited. So it's just an open question how these systems are going to work. They're just super experimental.
No, I'm just pretty much on the same vein as Jan and Phil.
So guys, a lot of this stuff though isn't like goes beyond the numbers, right? Like people are potentially buying Maker on it being the foundational stablecoin for all of DeFi and Web3. How much of that do you think sways the valuation here or potential valuation?
I think it's pretty much everything. to be honest, I mean, you can't go into a fundamental valuation of Maker and then come out with anywhere close to the current market cap. So it's really, like you said, more about the narrative of this being the foundation of DeFi for, you know, the whole Ethereum ecosystem.
Now, that makes a lot of sense. So guys, let's dive into a second example. Synthetics has garnered a lot of interest recently in the DeFi space. It's a project that somewhat requires its token to function. And it's not a medium of exchange token per se, but it backs the whole pool of derivatives that you can open up derivative against. So kind of functions on this bit of a virtuous cycle. And it feels like this is very different on the evolution of token econ versus what we saw in the past, which was all just, you know, to raise money or as a medium of exchange. Do you think that, and if you're familiar with it, synthetics kind of improves on, you know, a token with that could have actually some value here?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting model. And just to kind of give users a quick summary, basically the token is used as collateral in this massive pool. And the idea is you can create synthetic assets based on that underlying collateral. And so the collateralization level is 750%. So meaning if there's, you know, $750,000 worth of SNX locked up, you can effectively have derivatives valued up to $100,000 against it. And that level will fluctuate as the price of SNX and the underlying debt moves, you know, with or against each other. But the idea is that so the token, its main use case is initial collateral. And the reason you're incentivized to provide this collateral is because as all these users behind using the exchange itself buy and sell these synthetic assets, the fees accrue to the collateral providers. And so they used a pretty interesting model where they provide a lot of issuance early on, and then that issuance comes with lockup, so you don't have the immediate risk of sell pressure. But the goal there is to kind of bootstrap liquidity in the network and eventually allow issuance to come down, but hope that it's replaced by fees which are generated through volume in the network. So you bootstrap the network, you create a lot of potential liquidity by increasing the price of SNX, and then over time you hope that individuals will use the exchange and buy and sell these synths, because you can effectively have access to a lot of these derivatives products without slippage. And so the goal is to kind of use that to bootstrap the network, hope fees from trading these synths grow as the issuance comes down and kind of replaces it. And so it's an interesting model to bootstrap a way to get to a sustainable level quickly and kind of in the hopefully cheapest way possible. And so I think that, you know, the results that we've seen from them have led other tokens and kind of inspired some other token economic situations where people are kind of adjusting econ to potentially either mimic it a little bit or just take certain characteristics of it that work that can be translated to their individual tokens.
No, that's fair. Phil, Dave, have you guys looked into synthetics at all, or do you have any takes on Jan's points?
Yeah, Jan's definitely going to be much more educated on synthetics than I am. So I was actually just curious on a follow-up question. Jan, what is the benefit of using SNX as collateral versus something like ETH or BTC in your view?
Absolutely. I think it makes a lot of sense in the short term. Mm-hmm. To really help bootstrap the network, you kind of create this cultish type following, and everyone's, you know, just incentivized to help SNX grow. But in the medium term, it certainly creates a bit of a choke point, because again, your debt or all these synthetic assets are capped at that collateralization level. So ideally, you know, that only grows through SNX value appreciation, which is a tough handcuff to have. You should be able to allow growth itself to kind of generate more underlying debt. And so I know that they're looking into the implementation of ETH. And I think what that'll do is one, you kind of reduce the underlying risk of the overall collateral pool, because it's just not one asset, where, you know, ETH is considerably, you can say, I guess, a safer asset to hold. And then at the same time, you do expand the size of the potential size of the synthetic asset pool, which the value there being that the larger the size, the more individuals can transact on it. And hopefully that'll lead to more fees to those who are staking, whether it be ETH or SNX. And so I think it's a great way to, by just limiting it to SNX initially, it makes sense as like an immediate bootstrapping type mechanism. But to really get long-term growth, you do need that synthetic asset pool to grow. And I think by incorporating ETH as a form of collateral, you're really allowing that to kind of naturally transition.
What's the lockup period on synthetics?
There isn't one for synthetic for SNX that you personally stake, but if you're receiving SNX through issuance, which, you know, that's a majority of the rewards in the early stages, that's locked up from a year after the point of you receiving it. So after a year of SNX existing, you'll start to see some of those locked tokens unlock. But again, it locks a year after you receive it, so it won't necessarily be a cliff unlock where you're just having this huge flood.
Oh, got it. Yeah, well, as Jan said, it's all about the initial bootstrapping for any new crypto. And I mean this because if you can find a way to pump, as dirty as that sounds, your coin and get it into a large enough cap to be of interest in the ecosystem, and by interest, I mean index funds mostly, then you may have a chance of, you know, being a relevant asset in the space. Otherwise, I think as soon as those first lockups expire, that economic system has problems.
And the goal is that when those lockups do begin to expire, you're at a point where you're generating enough yield from the incentive where individuals aren't unlocking and staking because they believe that they can continue earning a yield. And so rather than having this mandatory lockup, you're now just financially incentivized to kind of keep locking up your coins. And ideally, like that would be the ideal transition. But, you know, we'll see how well that comes to fruition.
I mean, it's a great short-term mechanism, right? Because it's, what, 750% margin requirement? I mean, that's a lot.
Yeah, short-term sounds, in theory and in short-term, sounds cool, but long-term, it goes back to the long-term problem, right? Like, what's the expectancy of that being sustainable? Because that's the thing, like, in this industry, even the fundamental analysts, right, the ones that want to focus mostly on that, let alone on-chain analytics, which is price relative mostly, TA, whatever, right? Even those analysts are speculators, because since you have a very niche and minimal adoption in these assets, speculating on whether the governance or the incentive model of any given system is going to accrue value over time. And it all comes back to, you know, oh, I'm just going to, you know, select a few coins, diversify, quote unquote, and see what happens in a few years. So, yeah, it's hard to do. I'm skeptical about it as well.
So, Dave, kind of to cut home here, it sounds like, you know, you're probably the most skeptical one on here that we have, which is always good, right? That's a great thing. I'm just wondering, though, I mean, do you envision a world where we're Bitcoin only and a lot of these experiments are going to fail? Or are you of the opinion that the innovation is great, but a lot of the token econ just doesn't make sense here, or the projects are scammy?
No, not necessarily scammy in the sense that in the Ponzi scheme sense. I just think, well, first of all, I think that a field to study fundamental valuation that is not price relative to Bitcoin or any asset it's pertinent for sure. I think it's extremely early on because most of the modeling or hypotheticals you could make are based in speculative claims as reaching as TA in some cases. I haven't seen a model that has worked through time that is not price relative in this industry as of now. And even some of the price relative models are failing. You know, in on-chain analytics, a lot of the traffic has gone on-chain, just to give you an example. So that diminishes the value of indicators published since 2016, et cetera. So I think for token economics or the field of fundamental valuation that is not price relative in this industry, you need three very important things. And I think we're lacking on the three fronts, which are first adoption. And I mean that beyond trading games at exchanges, actual users deploying the asset for, you know, in a sustained manner. Second of all, a proper measurement of adoption, which is increasingly more and more hard to get, even for Bitcoin, because as I just mentioned, all of the traffic is moving off chain. And third of all, you need several years of adoption to actually trace and backchain performance and actually implement historical models on it, whether Metcalf, Odlisko, volatility modeling, option theory, whatever you want to do, right? You need actual years of adoption to then project into the future an estimate, somewhat valuable estimate of what's going to happen in the next few years. But as of now, I think we're in the very early stages. It's good that we're starting to plan and speculate about it. But whether we like it or not, as of now, we are extremely dependent on the trader games and, you know, derivative exchanges, the price of Bitcoins, and even Ponzi schemes, unfortunately, that can actually have a lot of selling pressure on the market. So,
I think, Dave, quick question for you to jump in. I mean, just to kind of think back to Wall Street or other fields like on equity research, you have your individual models. You know, you could do bottoms up research on, say, Verizon and see how many phones they sold and what their revenue would be. And then you'll have price models where you kind of compare different companies at different valuation metrics, DCFs, to kind of back into, you know, whether one's undervalued versus the other. So you kind of have like two different ways of diving into valuation. Do you think that we can still have token economic models where we adjust or enhance the individual projects at the project level, say, increase their validator yields, make sure it's sustainable, and then down the line, we get to this point where we're comparing projects to one another on a price basis?
I think you can do it on the short term. An example of that is the incentive model that Jan just mentioned with synthetics, right? You can actually accrue some value, but I wouldn't call it like fundamental value. I would, or accrual over long term, I would call it like fundamentals, as dirty as that sounds. I would call it a way to bootstrap and secure your short-term gains. Short-term, I mean no more than a year, right? And then, you know, speculating over that. And when once your initial incentives expire or, you know, are exposed to the actual market at exchanges or, I don't know, depends on the crypto, then you know what's what, right? And then you have the proof of work, if you want to use the pun, of what actually works in the real world and what doesn't. As of now, you know, the narrative Bitcoin as a store of value, it has proven to be the case over the 10 years, you know, and you can actually measure it quite easily, you know, returns over time. But I don't know, individuation seems to be a very extreme problem in crypto, diversification another. And also, since most of the models claim different use cases, so some of them extremely different, you can also like apply any given model to all of them, right? So it's exactly the same problem, but to size of the same coin. You have the individuation problem, where you cannot differentiate them enough because they're all correlated extremely. And then you have the unification problem, where the position on that asset, which could be, you know, utility token or store of value or whatever, are impossible to measure under the same umbrella, and therefore, you know, estimate their value over the long term.
And one question, Dave, to close out this thought here, do you think that we'll get to a point where we do have set valuation frameworks, models that can be compared on an apples-to-apples basis, or do you think that's still a major what-if for the crypto space?
As of now, I would say, yeah, we can get there. But I think we're 5 to 10 years away. Just top of my head, yeah.
That's fair enough. So, guys, switching gears here, Phil, Jan, I know you guys will have a lot of thoughts here. There's 20 new layer ones launching that are notable, that raise tons of money. There's the ones competing now beyond Bitcoin for developer mindshare and use cases and stuff like that. It seems to me at the end of the day, they're all either competing for dev mindshare or actual usage to drive transaction fees to support their validators. Do you think that the war between them will all come down to how much fees that they can generate from their users?
Yeah, so I guess it's worth asking, is this a short-term question or like a 5 to 10 year type question?
No, that's solid. Yeah, definitely a longer-term question.
Yes, so this comes back to the way I think about this space, you know, right or wrong, it's productive assets and non-productive assets. And I think a lot of these smart contract platforms, if they're still around, will pretty much survive based on a productive model. So with ETH or with Tezos or with Definity or, you know, whatever smart contract platform you use, I think a lot of them will have a staking model where you're going to stake ETH, and instead of actually getting ETH in return, you'll get an exogenous asset. So you'll get BTC, for example. And a lot of people have commented, oh, well, the network can't be secure if they're relying only on fees. And if that's how, if they're relying only on fees and they're going to just accrue value from this like exogenous model. And I
tend to disagree with that. I mean, you don't have it. It goes first from providing value to then having security, not having security to providing value. I think it's kind of a backwards way of looking at things. So yeah, short answer is yes. I think that most of them will compete on fees, which is going to be a pretty harsh wake up call, because I think a lot of them are kind of wrongly still competing on the store of value case. Like there's this like fat protocol hangover, and I'm not sure that value is actually going to accrue in that way. So I expect over the next 5 to 10 years for a lot of these smart contract platforms to be valued much, much lower than they kind of are today or were in 2017.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely on the same boat or in the same boat. I think, certain features will kind of become commoditized where, you kind of have to assume throughput and scalability exist. And so what's the next layer of competition? And then that's where that whole, fees and security come into play. And so, if you assume that you do have a certain level of scalability, then it boils down to, all right, where's the easiest place to build? What's the most secure? And security is obviously a function of fees, which support a stronger network. And those fees are a function of adoption. So you kind of have this circular situation where you bootstrap security in order to drive users. And then you hope that those users and all the dApps and everything built on top of it are enough to offset the lack of future subsidy. And so it'll certainly be interesting. It's funny because, you're definitely prioritizing low fees, but you kind of almost have to find that sweet spot between adoption and fees where you're going to maximize both.
So guys, thinking out, just playing devil's advocate here, thinking out just for the sake of learning and education here, like let's take a hypothetical, right? Let's say ETH and Bitcoin are still around in 100 years, 200 years, take your pick. So, I mean, like, let's say 200 years from now, Bitcoin's only use case is storing value or sending it back and forth. So fees would have to go up a lot, right? Like, let's say it costs $100 or more to transfer Bitcoin. Meanwhile, let's say a layer one like ETH has a lot of use cases built on it. So there's a lot of usage at low fees, but it's in aggregate, it adds up to a lot. Do you think that might be a more sustainable model versus hoping people pay a lot of money to transfer Bitcoin around?
So you're saying a lot of people paying a little versus a few people paying a lot?
Yeah, exactly. And it goes back to just, I guess, being a platform people are building on versus being a stricter store of value in Bitcoin sense.
Yeah, I'm to be totally honest, I'm not sure. I haven't thought too much from that framing, but.
Yeah. It would definitely be. I'm on the same page. I don't know. I kind of need to like play around and I feel like we were thinking about magnitudes so much larger than current setups. I'm not sure either.
That's okay. Dave, any thoughts there? Or what are you thinking?
Yeah, it's hard to tell that far in advance. I guess you could say that the Ethereum hypothetical you proposed would go through the velocity problem more than Bitcoin in that example. But, unsure. Yeah, unsure about...
That's a good point.
There's a lot of hypotheticals in that, like, Facebook or a Facebook equivalent being run on Ethereum, all that. I also think that by that stage, if Bitcoin gets to that level, a lot of the traffic, if not most of it, will be off-chain, and most of the transactions would be just multi-million-dollar transactions between, major liquidity hubs, OTCs, exchanges, extremely large whales, etc. I think that solves realistically whether it's a good solution or not. That's another debate, but I think that solves a lot of the long-term problems for Bitcoin. And also, a lot of the hypotheticals are very, like, if Bitcoin gets to that level in 100 years or whatever, even 50 years, a lot of the stuff, like, the inflation model, the supply cap, all that, I mean, those things are going to be major debates, like, the inflation model of Bitcoin is, if Bitcoin actually picks up and becomes a major multi-trillion dollar asset, that sort of stuff is going to be a worldwide debate, right? It's going to be serious business. So it's hard to predict what the result of that debate. I mean, if the Bcash fork was a large debate enough, imagine that on a world scale, right? So it's hard to say.
No, these are all good answers. It's a hard question, right? There's a lot of variables involved, and you have to think through a lot of weird examples where fees are kind of the only thing you're competing for and what's built on top. But Dave, back to your question on fees taking over for Bitcoin, do you believe that that will be a big debate when Bitcoin's subsidy runs out? Or do you think that the network will be okay with it? I know it's a finger in the air type question, but I feel like people kind of brush it off and don't really talk about it.
I think, well, being not actually given any given view of whether I think, I actually think the supply must be capped. But apart from that, I do think that if Bitcoin gets a proper multi-trillion dollar market cap, huge adoption worldwide, etc., I think it may be one of the main debates of the 21st century. That big.
I don't know, that's huge.
Yeah.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah, for sure.
Phil, a quick question on your time at Ikigai. What did you guys look for when you're investigating projects? Did any of this token econ, value accrual stuff kind of play into that? Or was a lot of it, you know, a huge cliff of skepticism and kind of, you know, convince us and we'll look into your project? I'm just trying to get a sense of, you know, inside one of the leading funds, like what you guys looked for there.
Yeah, the way that we would use this kind of evaluation stuff is to approach our trades with our eyes wide open, right? So we wanted to know what the asset we were trading does. You know, if it's a medium of exchange asset and we don't think it's going to accrue value over the long term, that's fine. We can still trade it, but we want to trade it with an understanding of the underlying fundamentals. So with something like that, for example, we might the way that we would look at it is, okay, the product is really good. The asset is lacking. A lot of people use Brave, and there's a lot of hype around the project. So from that perspective, there are short-term catalysts that may occur. People will, you know, invariably look at 10 million monthly active users and say, okay, well, BAT should be valued higher than this, right? So like there's that narrative that forms. So We would look at valuation and like these token economic models, not so much to try to trade or try to value anything, but just try to understand what we were, you know, getting into, and try to understand if there were short-term catalysts, you know, kind of coming around the corner. So in the case of synthetics, for example, we would have looked at that 750% margin requirement, the 1 year lockups, and looked at that as very favorable over a short time frame. And we also, funny enough, would look at some of these assets and use the term pumpamentals. So while something may not have fundamentals over the long term, if they were in a certain geography, if they had certain investors, if they had a really strong community, maybe there was a big 4chan check going on. Those are all things that we want to take into account as we would approach a short-term trade.
Yeah, and that totally makes sense, especially when you think about like the immediate use case for these valuation approaches, where trying to value some of these things, unless they're a really, really direct DCF type proxy, it's difficult to value these on an absolute basis. And so most of the time you're just using those kind of levers to understand where value can accrue and not necessarily to arrive at some intrinsic value, because in order to do that, you have to make some pretty strong assumptions for the next couple of years, and realistically, even a small error in any of those assumptions really compounds just based on the magnitude of these of the size of these numbers, basically. And so, trying to use specific intrinsic valuation is difficult. And so, you've seen some popularity growth in terms of relative metrics, where you don't necessarily know whether something is overvalued or undervalued. I mean, in most cases, you can say overvalued, but because the market isn't really operating that way, you almost start to think about, okay, well, is it overvalued or undervalued relative to this? And so you kind of take away the absolute and start to think of things on a more relative basis sometimes. But, you know, just because of the general rise in correlation, whenever anything really moves in the space, it's only as valuable as, you know, as the time frame you're thinking about, because realistically, once Bitcoin or something like that really takes off up or down, everything tends to follow suit.
Jan, do you think we'll get to a point where everything isn't correlated to Bitcoin, or do you think that that's also kind of a question mark?
Probably, but not soon. I think you need significant adoption and just growth in the industry in general. And so realistically, you know, new money is primarily going to be coming into Bitcoin and then some into ETH, and then it kind of trickles down from there. But it's just a lot easier for new money to understand Bitcoin than it is some of these other ideas, or at least on a more tangible level. And so because of that, I think new money moving in and out of Bitcoin, it's the most liquid, and everything will kind of follow suit until you really start to see a community grow in terms of both investors and users in the space.
Now, that makes a lot of sense, John. That's great color. So guys, I want to talk a little bit about Bitcoin. And Dave, you mentioned a lot of kind of on-chain metrics and stuff like that. What do you guys look for with on-chain metrics, like the NVT ratio, a lot of these ratios that are getting thrown out that are, you know, being used? Do you guys actively use these and explore them, or are they more tools in your toolbox at this point?
Yeah, we actively look at them pretty much on a daily basis. Well, most of the data points come out on a daily close. So yeah, most of them on a weekly basis, few of them on a daily basis. Some of them have lost signal because, as I've mentioned, a lot of the traffic is going off-chain, so you have to account for that. And also we complement that with every, you know, a lot of order flow, order book analysis in general, market sentiment, you know, BitMEX or derivative exchanges funding rates are a big signal right now, which is, you know, another confirmation that the market is extremely speculative at this point. Futures basis, which is also fundamental analysis, but mostly market inclined as opposed to, you know, any other valuation metric, as Ikigai does more often. For the most part, we focus on Bitcoin, since we, you know, we already accept as an internal thesis, you know, there's a lot of big players in the market that move it. Most of them rely on derivatives exchanges to their alpha, so we try to flow with them to get the same alpha. I would say that on chain is pretty much a complement to, you know, what we see in derivative exchanges, because a lot of the moves, you know, Bitcoin is quite volatile, right? So your returns, your monthly or quarterly returns, get quite effective if you disregard those moves, and we cannot afford that, at least. That's the fund's thesis. We also focus on the short term. So we play a lot with that. We focus mostly on Bitcoin and even more so on derivatives of Bitcoin, right? Perpetual and futures mostly. On-chain, among the work that Willie, Renato Shirakashi, Nicole Murad, and me have published, and Hans and a few others, as I said, mostly on a weekly basis. We may see, you know, a weekly roundup of pretty much every indicator under the sun, try to select the ones that we think are providing the most value, and disregard noise. And on a daily basis, I most commonly use, I like dormancy, which is a ratio between coin days destroyed and transaction volume. I think it's a good substitute for MVT, which hasn't given a signal in the last year, or that, you know, reliable a signal in the last year. I like Renato's SOPR. I think it's a good metric for swing moves and even shorts for detecting tops and bottoms, and a few others. But yeah, as I've said, we mostly focus on price relative stuff because whether we like it or not is what has worked so far and keeps being useful for, you know, diagnosing the next market moves.
No, that's fair. And yeah, everything moving off chain definitely makes it harder to track. Phil, what about you guys at Ikigai and your time now? I mean, are you a huge TA advocate or a huge, you know, advocate of these NVT rate, not like NVT ratio and the other ratios being thrown around, or are you more of a skeptic there as well?
Yeah. So the way that we typically were using a lot of the on-chain stuff was on more of a macro basis. So trying to understand cyclicality. So is price moving in lockstep with a lot of these quote unquote fundamentals? So is hash rate growing at the same pace that price is growing? Daily active users, daily transactions, volume, how are those things growing relative to price? Apart from that, I like looking at dormancy. I like looking at just raw Bitcoin days destroyed. I like looking at raw volume denominated in Bitcoin. I tend to think that volume is a pretty good one. It's also, people call it momentum, network momentum. Because in denominating in BTC, you get a good idea of the network demand relative to the price of Bitcoin. And just like the amount of transaction, the amount of Bitcoin demanded on chain relative to the price. So when you start to see that line sloping upwards, you then see the trend changing from, okay, price was too high relative to the amount demanded on chain. Is that a good short-term price signal? Maybe not, but I think it helps to understand the cyclicality of these markets, and that's been pretty reliable. Just looking at on kind of a weekly or bi-weekly basis, even hash rate, and I think it's a lagging indicator, but it still helps you get a feel for the health of the network.
No, for sure. Yeah, that's a good color on what's reliable and what's not. I appreciate that. And, Jan, you run our UTXO analysis. You've been doing this yourself for a while, with our other partner, Kevin, as well. And you kind of use this as a tool to judge kind of holding periods. What does this monthly report give you color on, and how does it help you think about Bitcoin?
For the most part, it really forces me to, stay up to date on all the various data points and things you can be looking at, any type of metadata when it in terms of Bitcoin. And so what you often see is just these general narrative kind of shifts, and they're often a lot easier to see in hindsight. But the goal is to really understand individually what's going to be the best explainer in the short term. What are most people going to be likely looking at? Because you kind of start to realize that it is a pretty small space, and obviously general demand can kind of come out of nowhere, but you start to try and look at all these other metrics to figure out, all right, well, there's still a lot of dry powder on the sidelines and with everyone trading. And so you can kind of tell that it's still a very trade-driven market just based on the liquid supply really circulating and how there's a diminishing amount of Bitcoin that's actually being used to price the entire network. And what I mean by that is that with less and less circulating, because it's primarily trade-driven, whereas a lot of individuals who are more so long-term oriented are kind of in a set it and forget it mood. And so while you have this smaller amount circulating, that's what ends up kind of driving the price. But oftentimes it does give you perspective into what the overall nature is and whether or not this is, just general supply and demand for Bitcoin as an asset that's driving price, or a lot of these, funds and other individuals trading and whether or not that's actually driving the price. And so by kind of bucketing out these different types of investors and using other data points to help confirm, you can kind of get a good idea of what the long-term directional trend can possibly be and kind of what might cause a reversal.
Yeah, no, for sure. It definitely gives a lot of color on holding and buying patterns. I think that's really, really significant for the space. So guys, just to close out, I have a couple rapid fire questions for you guys. We could kind of go in a circle here. We go Jan, Phil, Dave, just because that's the order of the Zencaster, to be honest. But guys, Bitcoin halving prediction, is this bullish or bearish?
I think bullish. I think regardless of natural demand, it'll end up being somewhat of a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think you'll have miners that will be incentivized to help generate some kind of price appreciation and momentum that way. And just because, Bitcoin is a very momentum driven asset, and thinking about what's the best explainer for price for Bitcoin, it's typically just price. And so because of these different momentum trends, I think you'll start to see, particularly on the miner side, some additional support there. And you also, as previously mentioned with the plus token issue, that selling will dissipate, and I think we'll be bullish in the halving.
Yeah, I think we might not see an immediate effect, but generally having the supply, the daily issuance cut in half, relieves the market of a lot of selling pressure. So I think over the long term, it's a bullish indication, but I don't think that, like, you know, halving will happen and price will go up, or even that we're going to start seeing a lot of price appreciation leading up to the halving. I think a lot of it tends to be priced in, but I don't know. We'll see. It's a big open question.
No, for sure. Dave, what do you think?
I actually think the halving is possibly one of the only reliable non-price related fundamental aspects that actually have an impact on price. On two fronts, for sure, you minimize the selling pressure in the market, which is, you know, crucial. But also, I actually think, since the market is so inefficient at this point, it helps speculators get bullish. You know, the traders who actually rule the market as of now, you know, the gamblers actually get affected by that FOMO. That being said, this cycle in particular, by this cycle, I mean what started out in 2019 with a 3K bottom up to now, it's extremely atypical, right? That's why a lot of the, that's another reason why a lot of the on-chain metrics have been not as reliable. And I think the primary factor of that is the plus token Ponzi scheme out of China. I think it had a lot of impact in the market structure overall, both on the way up and now on the way. I think it created an artificial FOMO for Bitcoin at the first stage of the year, the first two quarters, and also restricted the supply even further. Developed into what you could see on the chart into a mini bubble, and then it concluded into a blow off top that collapsed the market with, you know, an average, what was it like? I think 1.3K more Bitcoins per day on average or something like that.
Yeah.
I may be off on the number, something like that, and of selling pressure apart from the minor natural selling that goes on every day, right? So it's enormous selling pressure on the market, completely deviated from every expectation. Yeah. I don't know of any trader that at the moment the Ponzi was being closed up and all that was predicting such a correction in the market precisely because of it. Once the selling of that Ponzi, all the coins related to that Ponzi, which the best estimation I've seen by Ergo BTC is about, I think, 50K coins out of 200K. Once the selling of that is concluded, it's going to be a major bullish catalyst. I don't know how is that going to match into halving day, but I would say that perhaps by the end of next year, to give you a more conservative approach, I think the market should be much healthy by then, once the Ponzi is all sold out, all dumped, for sure. And once the halving day has had its, you know, fundamental and pumpamental impact on the market, I would say that end of year, for sure, it's going to be healthier. I'm not sure how much of sideways is going to continue. Mm-hmm. We still have to establish a reliable floor, which may be here-ish or at 5K, according to most estimations. So let's see what happens.
I'm excited. No, it sounds like, I feel like people really aren't getting or putting into words how important the halving plus the plus token Ponzi scheme ending is for the space, especially for Bitcoin. I don't think people really understand how much sell pressure will be gone just with these two things going away.
Yeah. Also, I don't think people talk about it enough, because it's a major historical test for Bitcoin. The fact that such a concentration of dirty money come out and transform itself into selling pressure, it's major. It's a major game theoretical test for Bitcoin at the moment. We're in a crucial stage for on a long-term historical perspective, in my view.
No, I agree there. So, guys, my last question for you all is project that shouldn't be in the top 10 and a project that should be in the top 10. No financial advice here, just totally your own opinions.
First, projects should not be in the top. I think one of these questions is very easy and one is very difficult. Project not in the top 10, you know, you take your pick at Ripple, Bcash, Litecoin, EOS.
That shouldn't be in the top 10.
Yeah, that should not be in the top 10. Project that should be in the top 10 that's not is tough just because that means I think it should be worth, you know, a billion plus.
It's a good point. Good point.
For that reason, I don't know if I have anything offhand right now that I could say is worth a billion, that should be worth $1 billion.
Well, a lot of them that are there shouldn't be worth a billion either.
Right. Yeah. I totally agree with that.
Phil, what are you thinking?
So the project that shouldn't be in, I mean, there are a lot of really bad ones, but probably Bitcoin SV. And then as far as the project that should be in there, the projects that have the highest ceiling are the money use cases. So the money asset that I think differentiates the most from Bitcoin and has potentially offers better or at least unique assurances is Decred. So that would be, you know, one that I would at least say should be up there, higher than some of these other ones.
Not be in the top 10, like maybe 6 or 7 out of the top 10. yeah, for sure. And yeah. I actually like Decred. Like, I mean, Murad, CIO Adaptive, has been very vocal about, but you know, if Decred comes to solve its main problem, which is liquidity, I think it could be a good long-term investment if the market ever gets smart enough, because that's the other thing. You speculate about, you know, what would smart money select in this industry, but you want, you know, actual smart money to come in, right? So you may speculate and that this is a smart money project, but then you need the smart money. So I like Decred. Yeah, I would say that.
No, that's fair enough. I'm definitely a fan of Decred as well. Well, guys, thanks so much for this kind of crash expert course into token econ and valuation. I think it's really great to have you guys and distill all of this into something people could, you know, listen to you guys firsthand and really dive in and enjoy it. So thanks so much for your time, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Good talking with all of you guys.
Likewise. Appreciate all the time.